Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. My name is Sharunik Boshu. I'm a doctoral candidate in the English department at New York University, and I co-host a podcast called High Theory, which is available at hightheory.net, where we take apart difficult ideas from the academy in very short episodes. Today, we are talking about a brilliant new book titled Making Women Pay, Microfinance in Urban India by Smitha Radhakrishnan, forthcoming from Duke University Press. Smitha Radhakrishnan is Professor of Sociology and Luella Lemaire Professor of Women's Studies at Wellesley College. Her research examines the cultural, financial, and political dimensions of gender and globalization, with particular focus on India, the United States, and South Africa. Her most recent book, Making Women Pay Microfinance in Urban India, examines exploitative anti-poverty practices that target women. Radhakrishnan's previous book, Appropriately Indian, Gender and Culture in a Transnational Class, also from Duke University Press in 2011, is a transnational ethnography of Indian IT professionals. She has previously researched the cultural politics of post-apartheid South Africa. Her articles have appeared in World Development, Gender and Society, Theory and Society, and Science, among other prominent journals. She received her PhD in sociology from University of California, Berkeley. Smitha, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for talking to us about your book.
Thanks so much, Sharunik. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay. My first question, could you, just to get us started, could you give us a sense of the inception of this book, and particularly this book as a culmination of your intellectual journey?
Sure. So this book has really been a very long time in the making. I think even as an undergraduate, I was drawn to issues of development and gender. And that's kind of what got me started being interested in academia and an academic path altogether. So I've been aware of microfinance. I've been aware of different kinds of policies oriented towards, you know, women's and quote unquote women's empowerment for a long time. But then my first book, I ended up taking a different direction with that and looking at kind of the upper end of the economy with IT workers. And so in some way, this book brought me back to the thing that got me interested in academia in the first place. And the way that that happened was really through my students. So I used to teach a gender and development class at Wellesley College. And, you know, it was a very critical kind of look at different kinds of policies targeting women and thinking about gender and development theories and praxis, you know, in general. But I always found that when we got to the microfinance part, it was very difficult to be critical. It seemed to be a panacea. Students found it very convincing. Everybody found it convincing. There was nothing that I could say, and there wasn't that much critical research out there that made people think twice. It was just such a neat story, right? We give women a small loan. They go out and start a business. They are more independent. It brings economic self-sufficiency. And then, great, we should just do this everywhere, right? And there wasn't, I couldn't, other than, you know, economists like Naila Kabir, who were painting a little bit more difficult picture, at that time, kind of in, I would say, around 2008, 2010, there really weren't very many qualitative critical studies of microfinance. So I started getting interested in this topic, and I knew that there was a burgeoning, booming commercial microfinance industry in India that really no one had written about at the time when I started thinking about this project. And so I started thinking about, okay, how can I kind of, go back to the things that I'm most interested in regarding sort of gender and political economy to take this on. And I started really honing in on training sessions, training as a way that microfinance companies would offer knowledge to their borrowers. And so my interest in microfinance training was really what got me going on this entire thing. But what happened, as is often the case, is that once I started looking into this, there was just this huge explosion of critical work on microfinance around 2010, 2011, 2012. Lamia Karim's book, Ananya Roy's book, just so many things. And so I started feeling like, all right, what can I really contribute to this space? But then it ended up just being a long journey after that, which it took me a long time to kind of collect all the data that I wanted to collect, have time to analyze it, historicize it, and then, put it together to make a contribution to this space.
Right. So you begin, in your introduction, you begin with a scene of loan disbursement and its affective implications. And I really like this. So you witness, I quote, a palpable joy among the recipients. And then you say that the optics of this belie how microfinance really works for women in India. And so I was wondering, could you speak a little bit about this particular entry into the book?
Sure. It took me a long time to figure out what that entry point would be because it's such a complex story that I'm trying to tell. And so figuring out where do I begin was not necessarily intuitive. But I realized that many of us, if you Google microfinance and look for images, it's this interaction at the moment of loan disbursement that often is the image that comes to mind, right? So it's usually a loan officer, usually a man, handing out loans to women who are just so grateful to get this money. And I didn't get the chance to witness that many loan disbursements. There were relatively few that I was, because it happened at a very particular time. You have to be in the branch in order to do it because they have branch offices. They don't really happen in neighborhoods. So it was quite by coincidence that I happened to be interviewing someone, not even at one of the main firms that I did the research at, where there was a loan disbursement underway. And I remember, and I'd already been pretty deep into the project by the time I saw this, but I remember looking at this and being like, wow, this is amazing. Everyone is so happy. The loan officers were happy. They were laughing. The women were laughing. There was just this feeling of like, well, this is awesome. Anyone who would drop in on that scene would not, it's just so easy to get taken into this just being an amazing event that's going to be the start of so many good things for everyone that's involved. And as I talk about in the introduction of the book, even for the loan officers, it's a moment of triumph because they have gotten all of these women to, fulfill the qualifications for the loan and then actually come and receive their money, which is a moment of triumph in terms of their own work in recruiting these women, going through all of the many steps, which I'll talk about later, to get them to qualify for the loan and then actually show up at this disbursement. So everyone is really doing the job that they're supposed to do in this moment. And so it feels really good when you're there. I mean, and there are many situations during the field work where even in some training sessions where, you can easily be like, wow, this is like a happy thing. And so I wanted to start there because I thought that it was a place that most people, if you've had an idea about small loans or if someone tells you about small loans for women, that would be a place where you might begin and say, well, this is great, and then I sort of contrast that with what is just beneath the surface, right? The interest rates that are involved, the various fees that are involved that people with PhDs in economics cannot calculate the real interest rates of these things. The amount of follow-up, that what happens if the women don't repay, what else is going on in the women's lives, these borrowers' lives, how they were targeted in the first place. There's a whole range of things that are just outside the frame of that scene, which gives you the larger context of what's actually going on here, right? So there's a way in which it's misleading, but it's also it's also that you have to start there. It's the beginning. It's that tip of the iceberg that invites you in.
Exactly. So, you know, going into these deeper structural factors, your first chapter talks about the role of the state in the environment within which the microfinance institution, MFI, which is an abbreviation you use in the book, it operates, and how it has changed the relationship between Indian women and banking over the course of time, from one of exclusion to one of extraction. So could you give us a brief history of this relationship between women and banking?
Yeah, so the way that you put it in your question, Sharanik, about how Indian women have related to banking from one of exclusion to one of extraction, I had to kind of come up with that framing. It wasn't necessarily there. So one of the big challenges of writing this chapter is trying to figure out, right, how does microfinance fit in to a bigger picture? What is that bigger picture? You know, is it just the history of microfinance? Do we just start in the 80s with self-help groups and just talk about the rise of commercial microfinance? That didn't feel right to me. And also lots of other people have done that. And I didn't feel like I had much to contribute in that. But when I really, you know, probed it further, what comes along with this type of finance is this narrative about financial inclusion. Right. And I've always been a little bit skeptical of that framing, right? Because haven't women always been embedded in financial systems in one way or the other, right? So what is the inclusion part of it, right? So if we put aside the rhetoric or the narrative about financial inclusion, like what's the deeper thing that's going on here, right? And so I had to really reflect upon that and do some digging about what was the context in which the self-help groups, which are different from the commercial microfinance institutions that I'm looking at in the book. The self-help group are the government programs that are linked to state banks that offer women loans, whereas I'm talking about commercial organizations, for-profit organizations that are separate from that. But I actually think that they are quite interconnected. And in order to understand those interconnections, you have to look at a broader, longer trajectory of how the Indian government has tried to provide banking services to the most marginalized. And so women are one group within that, especially women with marginalized identities, caste identities, or rural identities. But you have to look more broadly at, you know, the vast majority of the Indian population that has been excluded historically from banking services. And what I found is that it dates back to the colonial era, right? The British were very worried about, you know, Indian farmers not having access to loans that were not usurious. You know, they were trying to break down the dominance of landlords in giving out these kinds of loans, right? And so in all of these histories, you know, women are really erased in this. And where they pop up, it's when they're widowed or single and the state kind of trying to provide some sort of livelihood to women who are sort of left adrift without, you know, the support of men relatives. And then what you find in the literature is that really in the post-colonial state, you know, changed some things around from the British times, but, you know, really made very aggressive. This was at the top front of mind for the post-colonial state to try to get fair debt to out in rural areas. And there's a huge history there that I think we don't look at often enough when we're trying to think about economic development. And the, you know, what the post-colonial state did very well was building out an enormous banking infrastructure in rural areas, many of which did reach women. However, that infrastructure was not very well managed. And when more neoliberal policy regimes came into play, those institutions did not really make sense. Now, I'm not saying they were all fantastic, but we have to acknowledge that there were some important successes that the post-colonial state made in expanding the banking sector. So what you see in the more, you know, recent context is that you see a shift where previously there was an effort to get at women through these rural banking infrastructures, this enormous network of rural banks. And then when there's a shift where a lot of those banks are closed down and there's a focus on efficiency, women fall out of the picture and then come back as a new kind of ideal subject, right? So previously, the rural men, right, in that earlier period of rapid expansion of banking in rural India, rural men come to be seen as unreliable. They come to be seen as, not good subjects of debt because they drink, because they whatever, there's all these narratives that were going around, which I have some discussion in the book of why that happened, although I think there's a lot more to be investigated there. Why is it that in India, rural and marginalized men come to be seen as unfavorable bearers of debt? I think that's something that we can look into more. But what happens by the time you get to the 80s or so is that you have global discourses from the World Bank to local Indian governments talking about women as the new development hero, right? Women as being responsible, women as being, the ones who are going to really care for their families because men can't be relied upon to do it, right? And this ends up becoming a very powerful narrative that really hides the fact that women are more reliable because they're more vulnerable, because there are so many structures that can prompt them to pay that are not necessarily the same for men, and that this construction of women as development heroes actually doubles down on that vulnerability in a way. So it took me a lot of time to sort of figure out what that actually looked like. And so when microfinance institutions come into the picture, it's no longer just about including women. It's actually about maximizing the profit that can be gained from having them as part of the system. Right. And so I look at one very specific policy change that I focus on in the book, which was really like an aha moment for me that came very late in the book, is a policy change where the Reserve Bank of India, or the RBI, decides that regular mainstream banks can fulfill their priority lending obligation, their obligation to lend to excluded groups, that they can fulfill that obligation by lending to MFIs. So that happens in about 2005, and that really opens the floodgates for funding to microfinance institutions that are just targeting women, right? And that's when you start seeing a huge amount, a huge influx of funding. That's where you start seeing basically MFIs having more money than they can lend out, right? They're going aggressively. It has sort of those parallels to the subprime mortgage crisis here, right? You see lots of organizations going out into rural areas and giving away loans to women with very little verification, not necessarily looking at whether they have the ability to pay. So that's where the extraction part of it starts to come in, right? They're able to offer women loans at very high interest rates because the government had made it possible for them to receive these funds. So anyway, that's a brief overview of it. There's a few other elements which has to do with the global lending infrastructure as well, and banking regulations within India about how different funding streams work and why it is that women become targeted within that. But I'll let listeners read the book for some of those details.
Yeah. But we have arrived at kind of the last stage of evolution of the MFI and what the MFI has become. And in the next chapter, you take up the actors who participate in and the cultures that have grown out of this institution. And my specific question about that is, how does gendered power work there in the determination of these actors and these cultures?
Yeah, so that chapter is really about what's going on within microfinance institutions and within the microfinance industry. So one of the main motivations of this whole book was to bring gender back into discussions of microfinance. And one might think that it's somehow like, well, how could it have disappeared? When it ran in India, it lends to 99%, 90%. 8% women. But indeed it has. There's been some discussion about women being exploited, but this idea that gender is a system of power that not only operates interpersonally, but also structurally shaping institutions, narratives about skill and competence, and ultimately the distribution of resources that's in society, that perspective has actually dropped out of the discussion of microfinance in general. So I really try to bring that back by looking at MFIs through a kind of gender and institutions lens, gender and organizations kind of lens. And so I look at women who are employed within the microfinance institutions at different levels, from the level of loan officers all the way up to those more upper class, well-to-do women who are in the IT support roles as well as in IT as well as in MFI leadership. And then I look at what their men counterparts are doing alongside of that. And what I find is that, although these are organizations that are ostensibly oriented towards women because all the borrowers are women, they is not very friendly towards women. Women who work in MFIs face very difficult working conditions, often blatant discrimination for being mothers, and don't really have many opportunities to move up within the organization. And yet, those who are employed within the organization are incredibly effective in interacting with clients, right? Clients see in women workers a kind of aspirational version of what they can be. Clients look at, the women who come into their communities as loan officers. They see them as being independent. They see them as caring for their community. They see them as something that they might want to be someday, even though most of these women are, very underpaid and often don't have very many opportunities for upward mobility and often have to fight incredibly hard within their families to be able to work those kinds of jobs, because those kinds of jobs involve roaming all over the city. They involve going into neighborhoods and, interacting in people's homes. They're extremely physically exhausting. And yet you do see that, that it's only about 10-12% of field staff who are women, but those women are quite extraordinary, and they perform, and there wasn't any way to statistically check this out, but at least anecdotally from the people that I met, it seemed to me that the women were very, very high performers in terms of the metrics of the organizations themselves. And yet the men who also start in these roles, they have a lot of ability to move up within the organizations. They're granted strategic roles, and they are really able to experience upward mobility in a way that I found that the women actually face a lot more restriction. And this is highly ironic, considering that these are organizations that are ostensibly oriented towards women, right? But their own internal policies don't really reflect that. And at the top of the organization, at the very top of these organizations, and I do spend quite a bit of time exploring those at the top, it's really men with elite backgrounds. It's really men who come from banking or IT or education, who have had long careers within major sectors, corporations within other parts of Indian industry, and they have really come to become the corporate face of microfinance. And I have to note that this is a big transformation, because when the microfinance movement, the NGO-based microfinance movement, got going, there were a number of women in strategic positions. And as it became more profit-oriented, as it became more oriented towards not just profit, but really, profit in every sense, right? Really profit extraction, as it became oriented towards investors getting as much as possible, investor entry, exit. There are whole papers that are just written about how do investors enter and exit MFIs in India. It's like such a big topic. So once it starts being about that, the women are either pushed out or they exit. And you don't see women in strategic roles as MFIs become more corporate. So those are the kinds of transformations that I look at in that chapter, and the kinds of the climate within MFIs that I examine in order to question whether this is as, women-centric a space as it appears to be.
Right. So, you know, on the note of kind of the gender dynamic between men in power and the corporatization of MFI, and also their extractive relationship with women who are, you know, deemed, as you said, they're deemed reliable because they're vulnerable. In chapter three, you talk about the kind of the metrics of this, which is creditworthiness. And could you speak a little bit about how, you know, how the MFI measures creditworthiness and like what the socio-cultural factors there are?
Yeah, so in a way, I feel like this chapter is sort of the heart of the book because it addresses the thing which I think has been not sufficiently examined in the context of microfinance, is that how is it that a group that has historically been thought of as uncreditworthy, how do they suddenly become creditworthy? And not only creditworthy, but become, you know, the darlings of, you know, the whole Indian financial world, right? Such that, you know, there's people in internet, you know, there's these elite men who run these MFIs, they're going to, you know, global settings and the World Bank and at the UN and talking about, you know, how amazing their women clients are. Like, how does that happen for a group that's supposed to be high risk? And I don't think that, you know, we have too often relied on really essentialized understandings of women as being essentially good, essentially caring for their families, as an explanation for why it is that, you know, these women pay back on time. And, you know, as a feminist researcher, that's like not a very good explanation, right? Like there are social factors why it is that women pay back on time. I mean, when the pandemic broke out, I had finished most of my research, but I was going back and looking at a bunch of coverage about this. But in the, I talk about this actually later in the book in conclusion, but, you know, I was amazed by how well MFIs did during the pandemic. And there were stories of, you know, women who had, when all the money had dried up and everything had closed down, you know, women who would walked, you know, 20 kilometers to pay back their loan on time. And everyone's saying, well, wow, it's so amazing, like how committed the women are, right? Like not a good sociological explanation for why they're paying back, right? It really relies on these taken for granted understandings about women being a certain way. And so what I show is that there's a much more complicated story, that the loan off, what MFIs have done so brilliantly is that they have forged relationships based on trust with women who live in vulnerable communities. And these are not the most vulnerable women. These are working class women who have lots of opportunities, who are able to choose which MFI they want to borrow from, and who have some amount of resources. Those are the women who primarily take loans from these MFIs. And the men and women who are out there on the streets trying to get women to borrow, they have to stand out from the others who are trying to get their attention. And so they establish, you know, long-term trusting relationships that then allow women to trust their organizations. And so this chapter examines what Viviana Zelizer calls relational work, right? How are those trusting relationships where personal information is melded with economic information, where, you know, that feeling of trust not only comes from the fact that you know personal things about one another, but also because you know that you are relying on each other. And what I show in that chapter is that it cuts both ways. The loan officers need those women to take the loans and pay back on time for their own livelihoods, just as much as those women need those loans from that person, and they need to be approved. And it's actually a relationship of interdependence that's quite personal. So loan officers will gather very personal information about women and their communities, about the exact circumstances of their livelihoods, the restrictions they face. And there's a great amount of variation within working class slums that we don't, as outsiders, often acknowledge. We just say, oh, they're all poor, or they're all living in this working class slum. At least that's how the financial system has regarded it. That's how, you know, global development paradigms regard, you know, marginalized communities in urban India. But if you look within it, there's a lot of class diversity. There's a lot of livelihood diversity. There's a lot of different levels of economic stress. And for MFIs to navigate this space, they have sent out individuals who share those backgrounds, who understand those communities, to go in there and gather very personal information about what individual women or others, report it selectively back to the MFI, and then all allocate loans with the understanding, in a sense, that both parties, you know, understand one another. And it's that personal. So in what I'd like, I mean, this addresses what I would like to pursue further from this is how it is that those very concrete personal relationships get converted into algorithms. Because once that creditworthiness is established, right, it then turns into, it gets fed into, you know, a database, a record, a financial record. Right. And now these women have been recruited into the formal financial system. They have a credit history now. Right. That credit history is only going to tell you a very, very little bit about what they've gone through in terms of repaying those loans. But if the loan officers and those who are interacting with them on the ground can help them produce a good credit record, it's good for the MFI and it's good for the women, too. Because they can eventually take out larger loans, which is really what they want to be able to do, because they don't really have a lot of other options other than to take out high interest loans in the absence of, you know, access to medical care, access to education, access to housing, sanitation, et cetera. They have to get these things for themselves through these high interest loans, and these loan officers can provide it. So that's what's at stake when we're talking about creditworthiness. This is something that MFIs have cracked this nut in a way that government institutions were not able to do. So even when the post-colonial state was rolling out, right, all of these, you know, rural development initiatives and banking initiatives, right, they were not necessarily able to establish that person-to-person contact so that ordinary people, marginalized people with marginalized identities, would trust those institutions in order to be able to be drawn in to those systems and take debt. But MFIs have done that. And I think we have to recognize that in order to be able to make any kind of transformative change in the financial space, because that's what they've cracked. So that creditworthiness piece is really, really the thing that, painted quite a complex picture about it, but I think it's something that there's a lot more research that can be done probing creditworthiness, relationality, and how that then feeds into algorithms. I don't have the economics or the math background to really probe financial algorithms within MFIs, but I think that the connections between, you know, what is being produced interpersonally and then what actually gets encoded in financial systems and financial information systems, that's, you know, I think that is an arena of power brokerage and really gendered subject making that we have really not looked at.
Yeah. So, you know, there is a kind of, and I don't know, I might be misreading this, but there's a kind of verticality or like hierarchy in, you know, in the very concept of creditworthiness and the relational work done here. But then in, you know, chapter four, you look at other kinds of relationalities, which are at least, you know, partially lateral, because these are like social work by women who organize around the financial ecosystem of the MFI. So could you elaborate a little bit on the categories of organizational labor that you study and the women who are engaged in this labor?
Yeah, so I think the three, the creditworthiness and then this, the social work part of it, they go hand in hand, and I put them, I regard them as really central to the argument as a whole. And you're right, Sharonik, that the whole book is set up around this idea of gendered extraction, which is very hierarchical, right? But then what to actually understand how creditworthiness happens, you have to look at those lateral relationships, right? And what I unpack in chapter four is that there, even when they appear lateral, there are hierarchies packed away in there, right? So that chapter really focuses on powerful women volunteers who know their communities very well and who organize women into groups in order to connect them with microfinance institutions. So when those loan officers come into a community, if they don't know somebody who knows all the women in the neighborhood, there is really nothing much that they can do in order to draw women in. They are not in a position to go door to door and say, hey, do you need a loan? Like, we have this company. You heard of our company? Like, let's talk. They're not actually in a position to do that. When they go connect with neighborhoods, they need a key point person. That can provide them with information and can essentially construct a group. They don't have the know-how to do that. And it's women within the neighborhood. And in the examples that I show, it's mostly women who have a bit more resources than their peers. But sometimes it's people who don't necessarily have more resources, but who are better connected, who are involved in organizing, or they've been involved in self-help groups, or they've been involved in some other kind of community organizing, trade unions, which are stronger in Tamil Nadu. Some parts of rural Tamil Nadu, I met women who were very powerful, who were quite impoverished, but were extremely well connected because of their embeddedness in other kinds of social organizations that were far beyond the MFI. What I argue in that chapter is that the work that these powerful women do in gathering together, basically encoding the varied financial statuses of women in the community and assembling them into a risk pool that MFIs can then use in order to offer these group loans, that is the underpaid, unpaid labor that makes, the construction of creditworthiness possible. So maybe this is easier, more easily explain an example. So in the book, I talk about a woman that I call Sarojamma, who lives in Bangalore in a slum that's just tucked behind a very wealthy neighborhood. And she is an extraordinary woman. She's a construction worker who has, worked really has had a very lucrative career in construction, in carpentry specifically, not just in construction, but has, can construct a couch, has like power tools in her closet and things like that. But she also has this heart for her community and, has been out there recruiting people, connecting them, not just with MFIs, but with, laptops for youth, any kind of social program that's out there. MFIs are just one more that she tries to connect her community with, right? And she knows about, okay, this woman has a lot of medical expenses. That woman has a rental that she gets income from, and her husband's a drunk. This other woman is pretty well off, so we definitely want her on board because we need someone who's definitely going to pay. This other woman, right? So they all, within the community, they all have very different financial circumstances, and Sarojamma understands what they are and is able to get them all together, provide that information to the MFI, and then be able to, deliver the loan to all of them. That also means that when it comes time to pay, Sarojamma has to go door to door, make sure that all of those women with those varying levels of vulnerability have the money for repayment. And if they don't, then she needs to be able to be ready to either come up with the money herself or to be able to sit down and negotiate perhaps with other family members or other community members to come up with that payment so that the group will not default. So it's actually a very laborious, stressful role, and it's one that is unpaid. I mean, Sarojamma doesn't get anything extra from the MFI for doing all of that, right? And yet the MFIs cannot lend in groups that are compliant with the national regulations and with the state regulations to supply loans to vulnerable people unless they have women like Sarojamma collecting that information and smoothing over all of those rough edges in order to make that 98-99% repayment rate happen.
Right. So next you take up the empowerment training, and you say that in training it's kind of the obverse of the story, and and the ideologies it promotes, such as that of working motherhood, and you've already talked about the stigmatization of motherhood within the MFI system. My first question is what do the curricula of this training look like, and what can we infer from either its acceptance or its refusal among the clients?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, training was what drew me into this whole space, right? I was so fascinated. I thought, you know, if you look at what MFIs teach the women that they're lending to, well, then you can get a pretty good idea of what their ideologies are about what an ideal client should be like. So that's really what drew me in. And I studied a couple of different programs that look different on the outside. So one of them was about self-management. It was about teaching clients to be entrepreneurial. The module was extremely long, but what I saw was that they mostly just taught the first module, which was about self-management, and it was about knowing oneself. It was about this, it was really this kind of idea that if women could just know their own capacities, then they would be able to be better mothers, be able to take better care of their families, and ultimately be more successful as people. And that the problem was simply that they did not know themselves well enough. And that if you took this module, then you would recognize your capacities. And then that would somehow lead to you becoming an entrepreneur. And these are glossy modules. So one of the ones that I spend a lot of time looking at, you know, it was designed in Latin America, translated for and adapted culturally for the Indian space, provided in the local language, etc. Highly skilled trainers would come to deliver these trainings. And what I found were a variety of responses, that a lot of women were very excited that someone was taking the time to sit down and teach them all these things. But when it came down to it, this idea of, well, who are you really? You know, a lot of women found it kind of hilarious or kind of useless to even engage in this kind of conversation. So in the chapter, I talk about a variety of responses that women had, some very positive, some very negative. But whether they were positive or negative, it did not necessarily produce anything of that translated into improvement in their own lives. Very rarely. And so, and it's a complex thing. I do my best in the chapter to not present, a bottom line, well, this is how women respond, but rather to show that, you know, different women from different backgrounds, depending on the kinds of opportunities that they've had in the past, what their own aspirations are for themselves in the future, that sort of helped determine or helped at least contextualize how they received these trainings. The other training that I look at in parallel is one about financial inclusion, which has become a little sexier with funders than entrepreneurship training. But it kind of comes down to a similar idea that you as the mother, you need to be able to put together the resources that the community needs, and you need to be able to manage the financial resources for your whole family, and that this is part of what makes you a good mother, and that you need to be the one to do it. So although they're looking at slightly different topics, I argue that the message is very, very similar in terms of what mothers ought to be doing in order to be good mothers within their families. And I think that many of the immediate results of these trainings can be construed as positive. Again, like I was talking about the affective part of it, you know, some of these trainings, if you go on the website, I anonymize them in the book, and so I won't tell you the identities of them here, but if you actually go onto those companies' websites, you know, there's women laughing at the trainings, they're interacting with each other, you know, they're having a great time. So there is some joy that comes out of these trainings as well. But it is also the case that very often women just say, well, that was fun. Now I need to go back to construction, or I need to go back to the fields, or I need to go pick up my kid, right? It's not necessarily something that the content of the trainings is not necessarily transforming or not necessarily beneficial. It's not addressing the women's actual situated interests within their context. And so it's another one of these more lateral kinds of interactions. Part of my goal in looking at trainings, or not necessarily my wasn't necessarily my goal, but what the findings show really is that MFIs are not all powerful. They are very, they have to compete too. The women who are taking these loans are not dupes who are unilaterally grateful and, you know, just taken in by the system. They have to be convinced too. And they don't necessarily, you know, accept or enjoy every idea that the MFIs present, that they are active subjects too, who, you know, accept, resist, what in their own way. And they do it, you know, and this may be because of their vulnerability, this may be because of the culture, although I hate to use culture as an explanation, but they are very kind about it, right? It is seldom that women, at least in my view, and obviously I'm not a part of the community, so, you know, and I wouldn't be so audacious as to say that I were, but, you know, they are going to be nice about it, right? So the fact that they're nice to whoever comes to ask them from the outside in some ways covers up the what I see as really refusal or even resistance in many cases to these ideologies about how they ought to be. They have their own value systems, their own understandings of how they should conduct themselves, and they are not really transformed or disturbed by these trainings. And I think that's as it should be.
Mm, yeah. So, you know, you talked about this kind of dissonance or disjunction between the what you call the situated interests of the women who are, you know, the clients of the MFI and the, you know, the grammar and the content of these modules. And then in the final chapter, you talk about another dissonance, which is between, again, the situated interests of these women and the development actors in the global north and what they deploy as, and I quote, decontextualized understanding of third world women's poverty. So, you know, could you speak a little more on this?
Yeah. So when I started out this project, I was very interested in, you know, the way that microfinance was understood globally. And I started out with the understanding that this is really a global industry. And in many ways it is. But my findings in the book suggest that a lot of the way that the rubber meets the road, so to speak, with regard to MFI trading and loan deployment, loan recruitment, dispersal, et cetera, really have to do with Indian policies within India and practices within India. However, there is a really important global element to all of this, and I didn't want to ignore it in the book, even though it didn't fit neatly into the story as a whole, because I think that development actors, and here in the chapter, I talk about folks who lend on Kiva.org. I talk about people who are working in international development institutions that fund MFIs in India and in other places. And I talk about how those folks understand women borrowers, right? And what I find is that they have a stubbornly uniform view of the borrowers, that they really believe in this ideology that if you give them a loan, they will start a business and everything will be fine, that third world women who are experiencing poverty are the same everywhere in the world, that they you know, just need some entrepreneurial skills and some confidence, and that they too can pull themselves out of poverty. I talk about one woman who lends on Kiva.org, who says, you know, this woman has the same capacities as I do, and she just needs some help. So I want to give it to her, right? This idea of a shared understanding among women. And what I show in the book is that in the organization that I worked with, even when presented with evidence that it's a more complicated story, that, you know, these institutions actually shape a lot of the ways that women receive these loans, that entrepreneurship isn't a magic pill, that the loans might be used just to pay for a medical expense that they couldn't necessarily do on their own, that the loans are a very small amount, whatever it might be. I mean, there's a zillion, right, pieces of information that complicate this view, that folks who are outside, who are in wealthy countries, they have a stubbornly stubborn and intransigent view of third world women's poverty. They think that they understand it by looking at a few pictures. And I would have also say that those understandings are, you know, it's easy to come to that conclusion. They are marketed that way. When you go and look at websites, when you go and look at Kiva.org, for example, you know, it shows a variety of cultures, but it constructs women's lives in very similar ways. And so it's easier to walk away with a very simplified understanding. And, you know, and of course, the women who are doing those lendings, women and men who are lending on Kiva or who are working at MFIs abroad, you know, they don't necessarily have the time, the bandwidth emotionally to try to figure out, okay, what are the specific situations that women are operating in? Am I doing a good thing or not? They just want to do the good work and move on with their complicated lives. The problem is that when you do that, then you are just perpetuating this kind of engine of narrative and funding that is really contributing to this financial exploitation. And so I invite readers to slow down a little bit and to think about it. Ultimately, I don't come down on whether or not you should lend on Kiva.org. That's up to you. But just to understand that there is, a much more complex institutional picture that makes, you know, that should necessarily puncture, not just splinter, but puncture our understanding of how women in India and other countries who are constructed as poor, like India, how they actually live their lives and what's important to them.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like in some ways we have come full circle because we started with a scene of joy belying something, you know, much, much darker. And we are ending with this kind of excitement, optimism, and triumphalism of these websites and your call to look at something that is deeper. But I can't, in good conscience, let you go without asking you my final question. What are you working on now, and what is the next project that we can expect from you?
Yeah, so a couple of different projects are already underway, and I'm kind of looking to the next one. So one thing which is coming out, which is forthcoming from Palgrave Macmillan, is an edited volume that I've done with Gauri Vijayakumar at Brandeis, whom you might be talking to her about her new book on HIV/AIDS in India. So I would expect that her book would also show up at New Books Network sometime soon. So she and I have co-edited a volume called Sociology of South Asia that is sort of cutting edge new scholarship from on South Asia. We have work on not just India, but Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka. Not all the countries in South Asia, but we tried to make it as not as India-centric as it is by default. And we really think about how empirical work on South Asia can move us towards decolonizing the discipline of sociology. There's been a lot of discussion within sociology about how we need to decolonize the discipline. Most of it has been very theoretical, really thinking about the canon and sociological theory. And what we argue in this volume is that when we simply center a different part of the world than the US or Europe, you can move towards a very different paradigm of sociological thinking. And we offer a lot of context and a lot of examples about how that might be the case. So we really hope that starts a new conversation within the discipline and beyond. And then there's another book that I'm working on with Chinsia Solari on gender in the neoliberal order, which is comparatively looking at South Asia, the former Soviet Union, and the United States, and looking at how gender and how neoliberalism is underpinned by a gender system that is located in the nuclear family and subsidized and cheapened labor of women, alongside this idea of women's empowerment and women's entrepreneurship as really being really key to the neoliberal order. And so we are currently working on that right now. And then I am cooking up my next empirical project. I've got a few ideas, but trying to get this book on neoliberalism out the door first.
Right. The NBN episode on Gauri Vijayakumar's book is already out. It's on the website if you're listening to this episode, and she was interviewed by the amazing Sneha Navarupu. It's already on the website. And I'm so excited for all your new projects. I'm looking forward to reading slowly all of them. Smita, thank you so much for talking to us about your book. This was wonderful, and you know, congratulations on this publication.
Thank you, Sharonik. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
And thank you, listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope you have a great day. Thank you.